Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Okay. Our speaker tonight is Dr. Matthew Levitt. I'll introduce him briefly. He's Senior Fellow and Director of the STEIN Program on Counterterrorism and Intelligence at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy in Washington, D.C. He's a former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Intelligence and Analysis at the United States Department of the Treasury. He has been an intelligence officer working for the FBI. He's also currently a professor at Johns Hopkins University, and he's the author of a number of books, and we've just put some flyers out. Most recently, Hamas, Politics, Charity and Terrorism, the Service of the Jihad, and Negotiate Under Fire, Preserving Peace Talks in the Face of Terror Attacks. So it's great to have Dr. Levitt at the Sydney Institute this evening, and the topic is combating the financing of international terrorism. Dr. Levitt, you're most welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for hosting me. It's a pleasure to be here at the Sydney Institute, and thank you all for braving the weather and joining us this evening. For those of you who decide you're sufficiently intrigued by the topic, my comments tonight are based not only on my time in government, but on the study that the Washington Institute produced by myself and my colleague Michael Jacobson on the subject, the money trail finding, following, and freezing terrorist finances, which is available on the Washington Institute's website at washingtoninstitute.org. It's a free PDF download, but this one belongs to the Sydney Institute.
Great.
There you go. We face a variety of different types of adversaries today in a complicated world. And we need to leverage those tools available to us to deal with complicated adversaries, those that are dealing in covert environments, in covert activities. Identifying them is critically important to being able to disrupt their activities. And then finding ways to make it more difficult for them to carry out their illicit activities is no less important. One tool, not the only tool, and certainly not a tool to be used on its own, but one tool that is especially effective, and especially if used in tandem with other tools, is combating the financing of transnational threats. And we'll focus this evening on terrorism in particular. Now, what you'll often hear about in the media is only one half of the equation. And that half of the equation is the public side. The designation or the freezing of assets. Designating an entity, a person, a company, a charity as a terrorist entity. Many countries have domestic legislation to do it unilaterally on their own, such as the United States. Or multilaterally when possible through the United Nations, and many countries, including Australia, will almost automatically add entities that are designated by the United Nations to their national lists beyond their lists of prescribed terrorist groups that they maintain on their own. And that's very important. We'll talk about that in a minute. But it's critical to understand that combating the financing of terrorism involves more than just disrupting the flow of funds. It involves more than just finding ways to deny illicit actors not only the ability to raise funds, but I'd argue much more importantly, the ability to move money, to launder and layer money, and to access the money. That is to say, it's really great if we can freeze terrorist assets, but that shouldn't be our primary goal. Because unfortunately, even in today's economy, there are too many ways to raise money, especially for illicit purposes. And our adversaries will always be able to raise another, whatever it is, $1,000, $100,000. It may take them some time, but they'll be able to do it. Where we will have the biggest bang for our buck, the greatest impact, is focusing on key choke points, key nodes. Are there areas within the international financial system, the formal financial system, banks, the informal financial system, hawalas or other informal value transfer systems, where our adversaries are sending money, collecting money, accessing money? That's where we will have the greatest impact on disrupting the flow of funds. And we'll talk about that in a second. That's relatively public. Those designations, and sometimes the prosecutions that follow from some of those designations, become part of the public record. But they are not the sum total of our counterterror finance toolkit. Now, I'm not blaming the media or the press or the experts for harping on that first half. That's the half that's out in the open domain. But the fact of the matter is that there is an even greater half to this fight, and that is following the money. Not just freezing money, disrupting the flow of funds, but sometimes allowing those funds to move and following them up and down the financial pipelines to figure out where is the money coming from, who is giving the money, are they giving it knowingly, are they giving it for the purpose of financing terrorism, or are they being duped, and where is it going, through which facilitators, and ultimately, in some cases, to which trigger pullers. Ultimately, while it is true that it's going to be very rare to thwart an actual attack by using any one means, there have been cases where we have successfully thwarted attacks in part through the use of following the money. And I basically describe it this way. When dealing with covert actors that are doing things in secret, we have to leverage those opportunities when they are forced to come out into the open. And those three opportunities that we have, the three biggest opportunities we have, are international travel, international communication, and international finance. So you have these two halves of the pie, disrupting the flow of funds and following the money to identify networks, identify the relationships between individuals, figuring out who are operatives, who are passive supporters, and figuring out who is doing what. And this is critically important because the nature of international terrorism today is all about relationships. Think of it this way. Each of you now has tenuous, yes, but a relationship to Matt Levitt. If I go and rob a bank after this lecture, police may come and question you, what's your relationship to Matt Levitt? Now, that relationship won't be very significant. But if someone were to have conducted a link analysis chart linking me to you, if they don't indicate how thick that line should be, you may not know by looking at the chart that we only just met and that we actually didn't really get to interact because I was the one doing most of the talking. How we understand the nature of the relationships is critically important. It's not just enough to figure out that one individual has a connection to another individual. What is the nature of that connection? It used to be that terrorist groups were primarily hierarchical and you could penetrate at one point and go up or down and basically take out a terrorist network, and that is not the case anymore. Think of a ball of rubber bands, and you're looking at that ball of rubber bands and you're trying to identify any one rubber band within that ball. It's going to be very difficult. Peeling it apart requires intelligence, requires insight, and one tool, not the only tool, but one tool that's extremely effective is following the money. I'll give you an example of how important it is to be able to figure out what is the nature of relationships in this world of illicit actors that are trying to do us harm. The Bahraini government, a couple of years ago, prosecuted a terrorist cell connected to Al-Qaeda, primarily composed of Bahrainis, but one Qatari as well. They had traveled to the federally administrated tribal areas of Pakistan by going through Iran. Some of you may recall that the 9/11 Commission reported in its findings that some of the 9/11 hijackers had traveled through Iran. Iran has pretty strict visa requirements, but these hijackers somehow were allowed to enter Iran without the proper travel documents, without having their passports stamped, suggesting that the Iranians knew and were okay with them being there. Does that mean that the Iranians were complicit in 9/11? Certainly not. Does that mean that the Iranians were willing to look the other way with people who might have been illicit actors? Apparently. Did they know what type of illicit actors they were? We don't know. In this case, too, the cell from Bahrain traveled through Iran, did not have to have the proper travel documents, did not have their passports stamped. When they entered Iran, they were passed from one Al-Qaeda facilitator, Al-Qaeda facilitators in Iran, from one to another across the great landmass that is Iran, until they got to Pakistan and then met up with Al-Qaeda. In an interesting development, there was this reverse directional flow of money. You had people on the periphery bringing money back to the Al-Qaeda core, suggesting that the Al-Qaeda core is in some financial straits, which could be some good news, and eventually coming home. So what does this mean about the nature of Al-Qaeda in Iran? Is Iran part of the Al-Qaeda, you know, network now? No. But was Iran willing to allow people of, at a minimum, questionable character to go through their country without the proper documentation? Yes. You need to paint with a very fine brush when we're dealing with terrorism, not with a very broad brush. Understanding the nature of these relationships is critical. So was Iran, in this case, involved in some type of illicit conduct? It appears to be. But does that make Iran part and parcel of Al-Qaeda? Certainly not. And there are many other examples, and understanding them and understanding the nature of these relationships is really important. Because, for example, the Palestinian Hamas is not part of Al-Qaeda. They share some common ideological foundations, but Hamas is not part of Al-Qaeda. And yet, investigation after investigation in the United States and in Europe in particular reveal many instances where individuals are financing not only Al-Qaeda, but also Hamas. In New York City, we had the case of Sheikh Mohammed Ali Hassan al-Mu'ayyad, a sheikh who was lured to Germany from Yemen in a sting operation conducted jointly by the American and German law enforcement agencies to a hotel room where a cooperating witness posing as someone who wanted to donate to the jihad spoke to the individual, Sheikh Mu'ayyad, in a hotel room that was bugged every which way to Tuesday. And this person was very open about his ties to Al-Qaeda, his financing for Al-Qaeda, his financing for Hamas. And we shouldn't be surprised. Does that mean now that Hamas is part of Al-Qaeda? No. But should we be surprised, especially in the diaspora, where like-minded extremists are funding a variety of groups that may not be part and parcel of the same little basket? No. No, we should not. So, the message here is that if we want to successfully constrict the operating environment of our adversaries, if we want to make it more difficult for them to be able to carry out the attacks, and even below that, the logistical and financial support activities necessary for those attacks, a very useful tool is disrupting the flow of funds. I'll argue, and I'll come back to this in a minute, that a successful or an effective counterterrorism strategy, however, cannot be solely based on constricting the operating environment. That is too tactical. Of course, we need to engage in tactical counterterrorism to prevent those plots that are being hatched today. But we also need to engage in counter-radicalization. We also need to engage, for lack of a better term, in the battle of ideas, so that next year and 2 years and 5 years from now, we're not still in the same place, hamsters in a cage, running in circles, stopping the next plot. What do we do to prevent people today from being radicalized to want to do things tomorrow? And I actually think that there's a role for combating terror finance even in that, in one small way. And I'll get to that in a minute. So there's an important role for financial intelligence in all of this. A very important role in identifying relationships, figuring out who's doing what. The role of stemming the flow of funds, however, can also be very, very effective. And here, if we focus on those keynotes, we can have an especially effective impact. Think about the need, for example, for a cell or a group in order to conduct their operations, to communicate, to travel, to procure material, to bribe officials, to raise, launder, transfer funds. All of these require movement of money. And while it is not the case that every money launderer is a terrorist, certainly not, it is the case that almost every instance of terror finance involves some money laundering, some layering of funds to hide the money. And that gives us all kinds of opportunities. Now, it's not the case that all of these illicit actors that we face today are interconnected, but is the case, and we have found it time and again, that the suppliers, the financiers, the transporters of material and of human beings, facilitators of terrorism and of networks supporting weapons of mass destruction programs, tend to go to some of the same institutions, tend to work through some of the same networks and facilitators. The Drug Enforcement Administration in the United States, for example, has recently said publicly that they see that terrorist networks and human smuggling networks and drug networks on the southern border of the United States tend to use the same individuals. That doesn't mean that they're all one network, but there's a common overlap between all kinds of illicit actors, whether it's drug smugglers, terrorists, and others, in terms of the facilitators that they use. And this gives us an opportunity, if we target those keynotes, if we target these facilitators, to have a really significant impact targeting their activities. We tend to focus, however, when it comes to disrupting the flow of funds, specifically on designations, because they're so public, sometimes on prosecutions. But we need to recognize that even on this half of the equation, we have lots of tools, and we should use them all wisely by assessing any given circumstance and target and figuring out which is the best tool in the toolbox for this particular problem. If you have a broken sink and the plumber comes to your house with one tool, however fantastic a tool it is, you should be very, very concerned. You're probably going to need more than one tool to deal with that sink. Here, too, I would argue, first of all, we have lots of tools in the counter-terror finance toolkit. And that toolkit is only one of the toolkits. You may find yourself, through your intelligence, identifying people who are financing terrorism, and you may decide that other tools are better leveraged against this particular target than the counter-terror finance tools. But if you do decide that the counter-terror finance toolkit is the one you want to use, there are multiple tools there too, not just designations and not just financial intelligence, but other tools. Diplomatic engagement with foreign countries, capacity building to train countries on how to do certain things, things like public-private engagement, where governments interact with the private sector, provide some information about what they're looking for so the private sector is better informed and can provide more targeted suspicious activity reports that government can then use in a more timely fashion. In the United States, there's been a lot of concern about the fact that suspicious activity reports are overfiled. People are concerned that if they don't file something that maybe might be suspicious, they could be hit by a regulator. And what then happens is the government is drowning in overfiling of reports, which isn't in the government's interest either. Consider some creative examples, for example. When it became clear that the international community was following the transactions of terrorists through the international financial system, because it began to be reported in the papers, people started thinking, okay, how might our adversaries react? Because this is not a static threat. They will use more sophisticated tools, online tools, e-gold, cash-u, and they will use less sophisticated, the tried and true, like cash couriers. Okay, well, what might be some of the key choke points for cash couriers? Karachi, Dubai. Maybe if we had leverage our intelligence experts to tell us what might be some of the key choke points, we can then engage those countries and say, would you be interested in getting some cash courier smuggling training? And this actually happened. And the U.S. Department of Homeland Security provided some very creative training to some very key locations on how to identify and prevent cash courier smuggling, something that we have some experience on and still have a problem with on our southern border in the United States. I think one of the most critical things is to recognize that this is not a static threat. It is an evolutionary target we are dealing with when we're talking about terrorism in general, and certainly terror finance. So consider, for example, that right after 9/11, when governments started targeting the headquarters of charities that were involved in financing terrorism, some of those illicit charities, and let's be clear, the vast majority of charities are not illicit, they're wonderful, but there's a small number that were under the guise of charity financing terrorism. Some of them simply pushed the decision-making down from their headquarters office to local offices, which made it much more difficult for intelligence services to figure what was going out, etc. Or, for example, to focus on the financing of infrastructure, where you can send a lot of money for an infrastructure project, and it's very easy to siphon off small amounts of that money for illicit purposes. Consider the fact that you may shut down an NGO today, and in a week, or 2 weeks, or 6 months, or a year, that NGO, or parts of that NGO, will likely open up under a new name, and we have dozens of examples where that has happened in the United States and elsewhere. People using false names to open accounts, avoiding institutional accounts, using less sophisticated but more reliable means to move and access money, and moving into all kinds of new arenas. Our adversaries, when it comes to terrorism in general and to financing in particular, are limited only by their ingenuity. Consider the case of a Hezbollah cell in Canada. that this became public as part of a Hezbollah prosecution in Charlotte, North Carolina. I testified as an expert for the government in this case several years ago. The individuals were found guilty and sentenced to quite a long time in jail. Aside from the network in North Carolina that was smuggling cigarettes and raising lots of money for Hezbollah, they were connected to another network in Canada that was procuring dual-use items for Hezbollah. This is in 2000, right before the Israeli withdrawal from southern Lebanon. And Hezbollah at the time was still carrying out attacks against Israeli checkpoints, Israeli Defense Forces installations in southern Lebanon. At one point, an individual in Lebanon, Hezbollah operative, who had been in Canada, is on the phone with someone in Canada who's still connected to this Hezbollah network. We know this, and it became public in the course of the trial, because this is the only instance where a foreign intelligence service declassified for public use telephone intercepts for use in a U.S. prosecution. The Canadian service, the CSIS, provided 110 pages of summary telephone intercepts. And you have this individual in Lebanon talking to his counterpart in Canada saying, how about you take out a life insurance policy in Canada with yourself as the beneficiary in Canada for an individual here in South Lebanon who might in a short time go for a walk and never come back, carry out a suicide bombing? How hard can it be to have a falsified death certificate that says something other than suicide bomber? And then you'd be able to collect on the life insurance policy. There's no evidence that they actually did this, but they talked about it at length. They also talked about bringing in counterfeit supernotes, counterfeit $100 bills being manufactured in Lebanon, presumably, into Canada, and to procure their dual-use items that way. No evidence they did that either, but limited only by their ingenuity. Mind you, they did engage in all kinds of criminal activity to finance their dual-use procurement operation, mostly credit card bust-out schemes and the like. But the point is, they're limited only by their ingenuity, and we therefore need intelligence to be able to keep up with this ever-changing non-static threat. But maybe we should take a step back and ask, is this even an effective tool? Because the whole premise of what I've been saying so far is that it isn't. Maybe we shouldn't make that assumption, because, as critics will say, any given terrorist attack only costs a little bit of money. There's an endless supply of funds. There's this game of cat and mouse where you'll shut down an NGO and they'll reopen. There's a cost anytime you engage in a public prosecution or a public designation. There's a cost to your intelligence equities. There's a cost, perhaps, to your diplomatic or law enforcement equities when you engage in these public actions. There's always this tension between, do I keep following the money for intelligence purposes, which means I'm allowing money to go to terrorists, or do I freeze the money or arrest these individuals to stop the money, but then I stop the flow of information? So how effective is this? How worthwhile a tool is this? And I would argue, actually, that it's very successful and it's very impactful. One of the problems is that the assumption is, as I said, that you will necessarily designate, that if I find out that there's someone who's financing terrorism, I will necessarily designate them. And I say that because, at least in the United States, time and again, the way people measure the success, the metric by which they measure the success of our counterterror finance efforts is asking two questions. How many entities have you designated, and how much money have you seized? Well, as I've already told you, how much money have you seized misses the point. There are other ways to raise money. I'm much more interested in disrupting the flow of funds. And obviously, if you're asking how many entities have you designated, then you are inherently assuming that if you find someone who's a financier, you will designate them. And as we just said, that's flawed. There are many, many other tools out there, and we should be very flexible in which tool we use against any particular target. But the designations, and certainly these other tools, do work. But I'll focus on designations for a minute, because sometimes they're controversial. The fact of the matter is that a designation does have a name and shame effect. It actually does have somewhat of a deterrent effect. And I might argue, that this is one of the only areas in modern counterterrorism where deterrence works. Think about it. In the extreme, if you have a suicide bomber who is so eager to kill you that they're willing to give their own life in the process, it's very difficult to deter that human being. Right? The Israelis, for example, have tried to say, okay, you don't care about yourself, perhaps you care about your family, know that if you carry out the suicide bombing, we're going to, you know, bulldoze the house. But the terrorist groups, which play a critical role in this, it's not just the individual, terrorist groups, Hamas or Hezbollah or Islamic Jihad, say, don't worry, we'll take care of your family, creating this incentive, incentivizing, if you will, the suicide bombings. But here you have a potential deterrent effect, because by and large, the major donors who are financing terrorism are people who have spent a lifetime building up financial empires. These are not the people who are sending their sons and daughters to carry out acts of suicide bombing. These are people who are financiers, businessmen and women, and who are ideologically driven to finance terrorism. And we have seen multiple cases where we have designated individuals, and they're outed, if you will, and then they're no longer engaged in this activity, in part because they're spending a lot of time and a lot of money trying to get themselves off the various designation lists. And it sends a message to others, you could be next. And we've seen instances where that's been very effective. But I would argue that even if all the designations do is kind of throw a wrench in the system and force operatives to use slower, less reliable means of funding and transferring their money, but that in and of itself is a successful way to constrict the operating environment and disrupt their activities. Anytime we can deny our adversaries the comfort, the space, the time, the leisure to plan attacks in comfort, that we force them to be on the run, we put them under pressure, that is effective. But don't take Matt Levitt's word for it. What does he know? Take the word of Mustafa Abu Yazid, who's one of the senior-most al-Qaeda operatives in Afghanistan today. At the time of 9/11, was one of the senior-most al-Qaeda financiers, some called him the treasurer. One of the people who knows something about being designated, because he was designated a terrorist by the United States in the days after 9/11. Mustafa Abu Yazid has said, and I quote, "In Afghanistan, the Mujahideen especially need money. We have hundreds of volunteers for martyrdom operations, but don't have the money to equip them." So, for all those who say terrorism doesn't cost a lot of money, I say, that may be. But if you really want that cup of Starbucks coffee, which costs something like $15 today, and you don't have that $15, you're not going to have that cup of coffee. They have people who are willing to go on suicide bombings, and they don't have the money to strap a crude suicide bombing belt on them and maybe take care of their family. Not a significant investment. For those groups that are engaged in infrastructure, Hezbollah, Hamas, al-Qaeda groups in Southeast Asia like Jamal Islamiya, the costs are exponential. But the bottom line is, we have had instances where the impact has been significant. For example, consider the July 06 liquid bomb plot at Heathrow. One of the pieces of information that helped thwart that plot, just one, was following the money. Consider the case where British authorities recognized that there was a guy named Issam al-Hindi, they presumed, and they were right, a convert to Islam from Hinduism, who had written a manifesto about how and why, about the need to carry out attacks in the United Kingdom, but they didn't know who he was. Following cell phones and credit cards and other financial transactions, they identified him as Dhiren Barrow. Dhiren Barrow was not only involved in the surveillance of financial institutions in the United States, which I took personally because one of the buildings that was surveilled was the building next to the building where my mother works, but also a plot to fill limousines with darkened windows with gas canisters and blow them up in downtown London. He actually sent a detailed plan back to Al-Qaeda Corps, saying, here's how much it would cost if we rented the apartment. If you want to have better operational security, here's how much it would cost to purchase the apartment to put the explosives together. And the lesser of the costs was £60,000. In the scope of things, £60,000 isn't a whole lot of money, but it's more than enough money to have a financial imprint for authorities to be able to pick up on. And again, more than enough money that if you don't have it, you just can't carry out your operation. Then Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown, now Prime Minister, was quoted after one of the London bombings saying, and I quote, "that just as there be no safe haven for terrorists, so there be no hiding place for those who finance terrorism." And he went on to call for a Bletchley Park-style approach to terror finance. Bletchley Park, of course, the intelligence operation to help break the German code. And I couldn't agree more. The 9/11 Commission came out with lots of different recommendations. And a year after the 9/11 Commission report came out, the public discourse project of the 9/11 Commission, which was basically the effort by the families of victims of 9/11 to follow up and see how many of these recommendations had actually been implemented and how well, came out with a scorecard, a grading sheet for the U.S. government and how well they'd done in that first year since the 9/11 Commission report had come out. The only grade that the U.S. government at that point got in the A range, the only one, was an A- for efforts to combat terror finance. I wasn't in government at the time. This was in between FBI and Treasury, so I can take no credit for that. But the fact of the matter is that it was telling. And what was also telling was the 9/11 Commission report's recommendation, or suggestion, that while it would be wonderful to be able to disrupt the flow of funds, the bigger and more effective tool is the latter, lesser known, less public tool of following the money. And I agree with that too. And let me just conclude with this. I think there are other areas where leveraging these tools can be extremely effective. By definition, this is at its core a tactical tool, a tool to disrupt the activities of people who are engaged in plots today, a tool to identify who those people are, people we may not yet know about. But as I mentioned earlier, a comprehensive counterterrorism strategy has to include tactical counterterrorism efforts and strategic counterterrorism efforts, in particular, counter-radicalization. And I think here, too, we have an opportunity. Most countries don't. And while it hasn't yet, the United Nations is reportedly about to start. But the United States, for quite some time, has been declassifying intelligence for public press statements every single time it engages in a designation. It hasn't always done this. Right after 9/11, a whole bunch of names were listed. These people are being designated. Thank you very much. But I think they learned their lesson. There's something to be said for engaging with the public and explaining why you're doing things. If for no other reason to be able to engage in this battle of ideas, so that when people say, no, no, this wasn't really about terrorism, you just hate Muslims, you could get out and say, no, this was not an anti-Muslim action. This was an action against individuals who were carrying out illicit activity of the following very specific nature. That's really important. And it also provides us the meat for a robust effort to engage. To engage in this battle of ideas. To get out there and actually give a counter-narrative to the singular, violent, global narrative that radicalizers suggest to insufficiently integrated communities where what's happening to you in the suburbs of London or Paris is exactly what's happening to your fellow Muslim brothers in Gaza or Chechnya or Iraq. And the reason you don't feel integrated in London, and the reason you don't feel like full-fledged Pakistanis or Moroccans or wherever their families originally came from, is because you're neither, you're Muslim. And let me tell you about the particular Salafi or radical version of Islam that you should adhere to. This global singular narrative is something we can debate. It's something that we need to debate and provide a counter-narrative. The meat for this is not just at the kind of larger macro intellectual level, which is very important. I mean, the war on terrorism, which is a terrible term and I don't like it, the struggle against this particular threat is going to be won primarily not by the military or law enforcement or intelligence, but by ideas. But the meat for engaging in this battle of ideas is going to be this type of evidence that is made public. And I think, therefore, even in this, there's an effort to, if we make public the right type of information to explain what we are doing, we then have the platform upon which we can engage in a more robust effort to provide a counter-narrative, to empower other moderates within the Muslim community, for example, to get out there and provide a counter-narrative. And that's critically important if there's any hope that in a year or two or 5 years from now, we are farther along than we are today. We are not simply fighting the same fight then that we are now. In other words, we have to prevent the plots that are being hatched today, and we have to be strategic, have a long view, and do today, start doing today things that will prevent people from being radicalized to do things tomorrow. I want to thank my host for having me. I want to thank you all for coming out on this this wet evening, and I'm happy to take your questions with whatever time we have left.
Many thanks.
Many thanks, Dr. Levitt. We'll come to questions and discussion. We have about just on 20 minutes, so we keep your questions brief, and I'm sure the answers will also be brief, and everyone will be happy. But I also should say that at late notice we've put the Defence Minister, Mr. Jolt, that's given in the programme for tomorrow night, so some of you may not be aware of that, but that's in the programme. The programme's on the chair. So, questions and discussion. As you know, biggest terrorist attack in recent, probably ever, in our time, 9/11. What do you know about the financing of the 9/11 attacks? We just talk to the back of the room.
Sure. Look, the financing of the 9/11 attacks is a perfect example of how it doesn't cost that much money to do a tremendous amount of damage. Under half a million dollars to carry out these attacks, aside from the number of people killed and wounded, the economic damage, tremendous impact. And there's been a lot. The 9/11 Commission report goes into great detail if you're interested on the specifics of what we know, how that attack was financed through some specific charities, through some key major donors, and how the money was moved. Some people brought money with them. Some people did things as simple as open up accounts in the Gulf and have multiple signatories to the account. And before people traveled to the United States, they had a cash card. And the same way I can go up to an ATM here in Sydney and access my CheckMe account in Washington, D.C., people were able to do the same. In other instances, Mustafa al-Hawsawi, one of the major financiers for al-Qaeda at the time, who was later captured together with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in Pakistan, was fed Xing money. Perhaps one of the most interesting things is that Mohammed Atta, the head of the plot, described these funds that were left over as sacred and sent them back, which was very poor operational security. But I think it was something like $17,000. Not a whole lot of money, but saw this as sacred funds for the next attack and actually sent them back. We should be grateful for this type of activity because it enables us to have something to follow up. And it reminds me of the first World Trade Center attack. The first lead there was when one of the bombers, in a Keystone Cops type of a moment, decided it would be a good idea to go back to the car rental agency and try and claim the deposit, try and get back his deposit on the van, which led us to, among other things, him and the van once we had the VIN number. So we should be grateful for those opportunities.
Kristen, well, let's go.
You mentioned about counter-radicalization, and given the narrative that the war on terror is not war on Islam, I'm reasonably confident to say that there are millions of dollars that are moving around the world to promote a certain version of Islam. Mm. Now, how do you deal with that? Do you accept that? Yeah, that's right.
The suggestion is that, of course, that the war on terrorism is not the war on Islam. So how do you designate out the funds that are designated for Islamists from other kind of funds? I'm repeating the question because APEC is here.
Yeah. Thank you. Look, the first target has to be funds that are specifically targeted for terrorist activity. But as we've argued at in a Washington Institute publication called Rewriting the Narrative on Counter-Radicalization, if we are only focused on combating violent extremism, which tends to be the formula many people use, then we're 1 hour too late. That's by definition, they're already violent. What we need to be doing is combating the radical ideology that is the base for this violence. How to do that is very difficult, especially in places like the United States where we have a constitution and First Amendment rights. The British have a new counterterrorism strategy, Contest 2, and one of the things they talk about there is the possibility of targeting the finances of radicalizers. Now, would that be an effective tool? Yes. Is that something that we, for example, could necessarily do under our legal regime in the United States? Probably not. So that you've hit a nail on the head. There are difficulties in how you go about dealing with the financing of radicalization, because one of the key underlying things is, have people broken the law?
How effective are the methods that you've described in dealing with state-based terror, the so-called axis of evil, known as the evil phrase?
How effective are these tools to deal with state-based terrorism? I'm not going to use the axis of evil term. Please, that's in the past. They are less effective because states have massive resources at their disposal, not just in terms of lots of money, but they have diplomatic pouches, they have all kinds of means at their disposal to move the money, etc. Consider Iran, which is still the primary state sponsor of terrorism. The U.S. government's annual counterterrorism report was just released a couple of weeks ago. Europol report came out. The U.N. is coming out soon with its annual report. All of these have highlighted the nefarious role that Iran continues to play in financing terrorism. Iran is able to use state-owned banks to finance terrorism, to move money, and that makes it much more difficult. That doesn't mean that we don't have tools. Some of the actions that the U.S. government has taken, for example, targeting Iranian banks, have been focused on Iran's weapons proliferations program. Some, however, have been specifically targeting those banks for their terror financing. And so there are some things we can do. It makes it a more difficult target, and in some ways, actually, a little bit simpler, because there is at least then an address. You know what you're dealing with. Whereas Al-Qaeda is dispersed. There's no address for Al-Qaeda. So it's different, but still a useful toolkit.
So we go right down the back and come up here. We've got to hurry. Yep. Okay.
Last night we saw on television a disturbing documentary of how the NSA did not communicate with the FBI over information on the major regulation of trace the money. Who's responsible, which departments, and are the same sort of problems?
The question is, do the intelligence and police organisations in the United States cooperate with one another, and who has the principal responsibility for tracking international finance of terrorism?
I haven't seen the specific documentary you referred to, so I can't comment on it. But there's no secret, and I saw it firsthand. I was at the FBI still at 9/11. In fact, I led the analytical team for Flight 175, the second flight to crash into the Trade Center. And it's unfortunately painfully documented. Well, that's not what's unfortunate. What's unfortunate is that, in fact, there was lots of miscommunication and missed opportunities. The good news is that a lot has changed since then. Some by choice, and some because of the inherent cultures of these various organizations, not by choice, enforced by the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act. There have been a lot of changes in the United States, the creation of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, and the creation of the National Counterterrorism Center. Some of that is not so good. Lots of more bureaucracies. Some of those offices work better than others. But the National Counterterrorism Center, I believe in particular, has been extremely effective in coordinating as the mission manager for counterterrorism across the U.S. government, who does what and under what circumstances do things need to be coordinated. I think they've done a wonderful job. Nothing is perfect. Nothing will ever be perfect. But it is a far, far cry from what we had prior to 9/11.
Especially here, they go right up the back. Yep.
I understood that one of the most effective tools in crushing the mafia in the United States was confiscating their property rather than trying to get them into jail. Just a few minutes ago, you said United States laws wouldn't allow you to legally confiscate the money of these people. Then how can you do it with one group and not with another?
The question is there a precedent for terrorism of the kind of views against the mafia in confiscating property?
Let me be clear. We absolutely do have the ability to confiscate not just the property, but the assets of terrorists and terrorist financiers. The instance I was describing where we might not have the legal authority to do it is when we're talking about the finances of radicalizers, people who are engaging in a radical message but are falling short of violence and may not be technically violating any law. That's something that, how to work that is something that people are struggling with right now. The mafia case is a particularly timely one, however, because the issue with the mafia was not just that the government seized property, but we engaged in what we called Al Caponing them. Al Capone was taken down over tax evasion. Sometimes you don't have to have the big terrorism headline, the big terrorism prosecution, sometimes the information about the terrorist activities are too sensitive, too classified to be released, but you can get them on other activities. And increasingly we are seeing terrorists, in part I think because of the successful tightening of the noose around their financial activities, engaging in criminal activity. Criminal activity is very, very lucrative, especially narcotics. And we see Hezbollah and other groups getting very involved in the international drug trade, but it's very, very poor operational security. You know, you might be become on the radar of law enforcement, not for your terrorist activity. We had no idea about your terrorist activity, but we stumbled across you because of the laws you were breaking. And so it gives us an opportunity there too. And I've often said, especially for example, when it comes to a group like Hezbollah, the terrorist wing of Hezbollah is designated here in Australia, not the group writ large. The group is not designated at all in the European Union. It is designated writ large in the United States. How do we navigate those differences? In part, now that Hezbollah is so actively involved in their international drug trade, I think we will see several cases where you won't hear the word Hezbollah or terrorism, but a drug ring will be taken down and it will happen to have been a Hezbollah element, and that's fine with me. I don't think we need to have the big T terrorism word in every instance.
Right up against the back wall.
Yeah. Thank you. I wanted to look at more of the operational aspects of the funding, and you mentioned before regarding placement of funds and layering insurance scams, for example. Has there been any other interesting ways which terrorists have placed their funds or layered their funds, especially in regards to the financial markets or areas like that that you've come across?
Question about ways, other ways of placing funds beyond the traditional ones.
Like I said, this is not a static threat. It's an ever-evolving threat. And so just because we haven't seen something, A, doesn't mean it won't happen tomorrow, and for that matter, doesn't mean isn't happening already. But there's been a lot of speculation, especially since that James Bond movie came out, about terrorists playing the market, that type of thing. Excuse me. I know no evidence that that's actually happened. Could it happen? Who knows? Even the example I gave you, it was notional, this idea of using an insurance scam. Excuse me, I'm breaking your toys here.
Sophisticated intelligence. I'm not the FBI.
But there are lots of creative ways to do things, to move money. There are all kinds of interesting ways on the internet right now. All kinds of ways in the non-formal financial sector and informal value transfer systems. M-payments via cell phone are a difficult thing. There are lots of ways that, like I said, our adversaries in response to our activities will become both more sophisticated and in some cases revert to less sophisticated measures too. Frankly, the better ones will use combinations and not put all their eggs in one basket.
So there's a question down there. Yeah. Yes, yeah, go for it. We've got to be quick. Yep.
Terrorism seems to imply indiscriminate slaughter, but I've heard about other terrorists considering financial markets, for instance. Do you have any thoughts about whether the financial market could target, and is your
okay, the question is whether terrorist markets are trying to destroy financial markets.
Al-Qaeda's made many statements saying very specifically that one of the things they want to do is to hurt us financially. They love the fact that what has happened since 9/11, both in terms of the war in Afghanistan and then the war in Iraq, have bled us financially, especially the United States. I think they're still keenly interested in killing as many people as possible, especially Al-Qaeda. Other groups are keen on killing people, but maybe not as many people as possible. It doesn't necessarily need to be indiscriminate, though it often is. But it goes without saying that our adversaries are giddy over the fact that these attacks hurt us financially. And I think it is not coincidence that 9/11 targeted the financial sector.
A quick question. In addition to the money pipeline, what other pipelines do you follow? Take, for instance, the weapons. There may be a relationship between money and weapons. And there may not be a relationship. As you know, there are many very poor groups in the world that fight X, Y, and Z, and yet they may not have any money to buy it. So wouldn't you follow the weapons pipeline?
There are multiple pipelines to follow, and certainly people follow the weapons pipeline, the drugs pipeline, human smuggling pipelines, the money you will often see overlap. They're not all the same, but you will see overlap. You won't find an instance where people are so poor that they didn't have money, but they have weapons. Because either someone gave them the money to get the weapons, or someone gave them the weapons. And now, I don't make a distinction as to whether you gave me the dollar to buy the bullet or you gave me the bullet. Either way, it's what we in the United States describe as material support. There are multiple pipelines, and we should be following them all, of course.
Final question, Stuart McMaster.
Oh, right. Do you use the same techniques against the Timothy McVeighs of the world?
Do we use the same techniques against domestic terrorists like Timothy McVeigh? Very similar techniques, yes. The FBI, for example, has both an international terrorism section and a domestic terrorism section. When the new director of national intelligence, Denny Blair, gave his state of the threat testimony before the House and Senate in March, he shocked everybody by not starting with terrorism, not starting with Pakistan, not starting with Iran, not starting with the Arab-Israeli conflict, not starting with Iraq. He started with the international financial crisis. And that's very, very significant, and I thought wise. He noted in there, however, that studies show that any time a financial crisis persists for a year to 2 years, you see a sharp increase in radicalization. And that will include not only the kind of radical Islamist extremism that we see in terrorism, particularly today, but it will also be domestic terrorism. We, I'm very proud to say, have the first African-American president in the United States. That's going to get the attention of white supremacists and others. And we need to be no less aware of them and what they're doing, of course.
Many thanks. Just take a seat.
Thank you.
I'll be very brief. It's great that Dr. Levitt could spare his time to talk to us tonight. What we've found is, in our speaker, who is a well-known in the United States, well-known author and commentator, and currently an academic, but also someone who works in a think tank. But I think most importantly, someone who has a background not only in the FBI, which is important, but also in the Department of the Treasury. And it's this skill of working through government and related bodies and also working in the public domain and in universities, which I think gives our speaker considerable authority to talk on the topic of combating the international finance of terrorism. So tonight, it's been a very informative night. We've had a lively question and discussion period. It'll make a good paper for the Sydney papers when it's published, and it'll be up on our podcast within a day or so. But for tonight, to say to our speaker, well done and many thanks.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.